Every time our athletes walk into this weight room, they're going to be pushed to the max.
Let's go!
The barbell hasn't changed in over 100 years. I can take a 25-pound plate, and we'll go out on the turf, and I'll have you hating life. We talk about straining your gut, pushing past that comfort level. I want a lot of energy.
What better breeding ground is there for being a success in life than the weight room?
Hey guys, welcome back to Iron Game Chalk Talk. I'm your host, Ron McKeefrey, and this is episode number 199, one away from episode 200, which is going to be a huge milestone for us, and super excited about that episode. We're going to have Mark Kasanovich on. Mark is one of my biggest mentors, probably the biggest mentor in my career. I worked for at Tampa Bay, and one of the guys that when I earmarked, you know, that I set out to do this project, there was three people that I wanted to have on the show and wanted to make sure I kind of proved myself with the show before I had them on. And so Mark being one of the biggest, it's taken me 200 episodes, but super pumped about that. Very excited about this episode. We have Carmen Bott. Carmen is a professor at LeGarra College up in Vancouver. She is a practicing strength and conditioning coach as well, owns Human Motion Strength and Conditioning. She works with Wrestling Canada and a number of other athletes at the professional and collegiate level. I did not really know Carmen much before this episode, but I'm telling you what, she is awesome. And I had a really, really good conversation with her. She challenged me in some areas, which I absolutely love. I love to grow as a strength coach. And she challenged me in a couple of my own opinions and thoughts. And so I was great about that. We dig into a lot. We talk about, you know, obviously, those gladiator sports and those mat sports, and some of the tendencies and common areas of deficiency and things along those lines. We talk about, the role of a scientist and a practitioner and kind of, how she's been able to blend the two of those. And then we get into, being a female strength coach, working primarily with gladiator sports, and how she's been able to navigate this profession, especially, having been in it for a little bit, back when it wasn't very popular at all for female strength coaches to be in those roles. And I just absolutely love her approach. I mean, she just went after what she wanted and didn't let anybody or anything coming her way. And I think that's absolutely the right advice, regardless of gender, race, those types of things. And so there's tons of great information in this episode. I know you're going to get a ton out of this. Before we do, we want to recognize our sponsor, Gym Aware, for this episode. As you know, Gym Aware came on board this year, and I really just love the functionality of this measuring device, being able to measure peak power output and velocity, and the ability to move it around the weight room and to implement it in your program in various different ways. And so if you have not checked out Gym Aware, I would highly encourage you to do so. I think they're a great product. Evan and his family I've gotten to know through the years and really think the world of him. I think it's, again, it goes a long way, in my opinion, as a strength coach to when companies go out of their way, to give back to the community. And by, supporting the play summits, it just goes to tell you much about them as a company and who they are as individuals. And so, if you're not in the market, I'd encourage you to follow them on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all the different social media outlets, as they're constantly going into different facilities and doing some phenomenal things and putting out some great content, on velocity-based training and where that's going. And so I'd encourage you to follow them and then just let them know how much you appreciate them being a part of the show. Lastly, before we get going, Play Summits. We just got done with the Woodstock Summit that turned out phenomenal. We've got three done now. We're going to our fourth site this weekend in Baltimore at the Under Armour headquarters. So if you're in the Northeast, this is the summit for you. It's going to be at a great location, obviously. And then we have fantastic speakers, Rick Court, Craig Fitzgerald from the Texans, Rick's from Maryland. Aaron Wellman from the Giants, Dana Santos, Mobility Maker, Zach Emanesh, Underground Strength, and Joe Connolly, UMass. And so just an all-star lineup there of speakers as well. So sit back, enjoy this episode, and we'll see you on the other side.
All right, guys, welcome back to Iron Game Chalk Talk. Super excited to have Carmen Bott with us today. Carmen is up in Canada, and we've been trying to set this up for quite some time, and I have dropped the ball and had to reschedule a couple times, but I'm super excited to have you on the show. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Ron. It's my pleasure.
Carmen, just for everybody that's just now getting to know you, and we don't know each other that well, but kind of similar circles and the whole deal, but tell everybody a little bit about your background, kind of what, you know, how you got into strength and conditioning and what's led you down your path there.
Okay. Well, I hopefully won't bore everybody with the details and give away my age, but I did start quite young at the age of 19 with some personal training, and I quickly realized that that wasn't necessarily where my heart lied because I was always an athlete. So I started working with my first collegiate women's basketball team at the age of 20 and, you know, had a few certifications in training, was in university taking kinesiology. And then it just sort of, you know, spurred from there. I had opportunities to travel to Southeast Asia in my mid 20s. I worked with, you know, athletes that didn't speak any English, coaches that didn't speak any English. I remember walking home crying every day thinking, what have I done? Grew up real fast. And then, came back to my hometown, finished off my undergrad. At the time, I was working with a lot of NHL and junior level hockey players. You know, being in Canada, there's a big market for that. And still with basketball, worked with Basketball Canada and UBC Basketball, took them to a couple of national championships in my 20s, and then decided to do a master's degree. So when I finished my master's, I went into some teaching, and at that point I was just working sectionally at the university teaching upper level human kinetics courses and coaching. And now I'm on full-time faculty. I've been full-time with the institution I'm at for about 5 years, and I split that time between teaching and coaching still. So it's been a while.
Well, you know, I think there's, and you probably want even maybe more brief than I would want you to go there, because you've had some phenomenal experiences working with a number of really high level athletes and various gladiator type of sports, you know. And I think that that's something that you go back to early on. I mean, 19 years old, 20 years old, you're working with NHL hockey players as a female strength coach, you know, back when it was, you know, when strength and conditioning wasn't, you know, what it is even today, you know. And so you've been doing this at a high level, pretty much from the very beginning, being a female strength coach in a very dominated, male-dominated kind of profession.
Yeah.
What advice would you have for the young female strength coaches that are just coming into the field that maybe you want to be the next head strength coach in the NFL or NHL or something along those lines, and they're looking at it going, you know what, I just don't see anybody like me at those levels?
You know, that's a good question. You know, I'm not always the best person to ask because I don't really know how I got to where I am other than, you know, just determination and hard work and the things you and I have already talked about, and a can-do attitude. I've never looked at being a woman. Like, I've been asked to speak at conferences because I'm a woman, and I've declined because of that. Maybe that's me having a big ego. I don't know, but, you know, I guess, first of all, if you're going to work with, you know, football players, hockey players, you have to be strong. You know, you have to be fit. You have to look the part. You have to be athletic. But I would probably say that to a male strength coach, too. You know, if this is a physical job, you're basically a construction worker in a weight room. So you're moving, you know, equipment. I had to pick up a dumbbell for one of my CFL guys this morning that was 125 pounds, right? And you have to do that without looking like a complete goofball. So, you know, I think there's that part, but now as I'm getting older and growing more wrinkles on my face and cannot rely solely on my athletic ability, I've gotten a different level of respect based on my academic training and my knowledge and my ability to explain, you know, why we're doing what we're doing, and sort of instill that belief on the athlete in me that I can do the job and I can take them where they need to go. And if I don't know what to do, then I also have a great network that I can rely on. So, you know, hopefully that's, you know, helpful for the females out there, but then also for any males that want to coach at a high level, because there aren't a lot of jobs, you know, doing this. So it is competitive.
Right. I think, you know, and as a guy that, you know, I've never in my career blinked at hiring a female strength coach or a strength coach because of their ethnicity or whatever it might be. I've always looked at, you know, the situation where every strength coach faces obstacles, whatever those may be. You know, maybe you didn't play the sport you're working with, or maybe you, you know, maybe you're a female strength coach working with male sports or vice versa. You know, I think every strength coach has obstacles they have to overcome, and then you have to attack those obstacles, whatever they may be. And the best way to do that is, A, what you said, I think, is working extremely hard, you know, and two, I always say fake it till you make it. So you need to act like you belong. You know, you need to, if I'm working with women's golf, then I need to act like I know what I'm talking about when it comes to golf until I've educated myself enough to where I can speak intelligently about it and feel like I understand the sport and be able to use the lingo and things along those lines. But I think
absolutely. You have to be a student of the sports. You know, no, definitely. When I started working with MMA athletes, I started doing submission wrestling and kickboxing. You know, I played flag football for 10 years because they didn't have gridiron. So I do, you know, I understand the sport from a tactical standpoint, but even a demand standpoint too. And you're right, that's important because then you can get on the level of the athlete.
Yeah, I think that's so. I think when I often get crucified when I speak because never once do I think gender or ethnicity is an issue. I do think that to be a great strength coach at a sport, you need to have played it, you know, to fully understand the sport. I think you need to, that means you also need to understand what the rigors of being an athlete in that sport have been. And so I think that that's always, I mean, I think there's great strength coaches, don't get me wrong. And I think that there's a situation where you could have worked with the sport for many, many years, you know, and oftentimes being in football, I always get, you know, somebody that maybe didn't play football that they have to overcome not having been an athlete in that sport. And they can become a great strength coach by being in it for many, many years and understanding. But I think there's a level of understanding that exists if you've played it versus didn't play it. So, you, like example, you doing the submission wrestling and playing flag football obviously gives you an understanding of what those athletes go through much more than anybody that would never have played that sport. And I completely agree with that.
It's a bit of a strange mentality. I'm a bit of a mad scientist, but you know, I'm a gamer, so whatever, right? One life, let's do it.
That's totally you. I can that comes across in everything you do, even in our email conversations. That totally comes across.
Okay,
I can
good. See that. I'm glad.
You know, when you mentioned, like, you know, you got over in Southeast Asia and there's times when you were walking, you know, you were crying going home, you know, and you wondered what you had done, you know, along these ways and along this long career that you've had, you know, at a high level, you've made some mistakes, you know, along the way. What's maybe the biggest mistake you've made as a strength and conditioning coach and then kind of how you learned from it?
Yeah, every mistake I've made, I'll be honest, I can't think of the biggest one, but I can think of a theme, and it always boils down to communication with either the coach or the coaching staff on a decision maybe I made on behalf of an athlete and didn't notify the coaching staff or discuss it with the coaching staff, because at the end of the day, they're your boss, because I thought it was maybe the right decision at the time. So it does often boil down to that. And the other piece is communication with the athlete. So there'd be times when I have very high expectations, almost too high at times. And I've gotten very good at outlining those and being very clear on my message with these young kids that I'm working with. And instead of, you know, me having expectations in my head, then training them or coaching them and them not meeting them and me not saying anything and, you know, the story, I guess you could call it, is building up in your own head as to what you think is going on without any communication, it becomes much more dramatic and much, more significant than it really needs to be. So the mistakes I've made have always been around misunderstandings that have stemmed from poor communication. So one thing that I do when I bring on a new client is I take the time to have a consult with them, and that's face to face. It's in person at a coffee shop, you know, or at the gym, but not in the gym, where we just talk about goals. We talk about what training looks like. We paint that picture. We talk about expectations. You know, for example, if an athlete brings a cell phone into the gym, they better not be texting. And, you know, instead of me telling them, look, it don't text, you know, and be a control freak, I just say, hey, you know what? Like, let's look at what are the habits of a world champion. And does the habits of a world champion include being distracted? And if being distracted means you have a phone with you, well, then maybe we need to investigate that. So, you know, I think communication is really important. And you know, even with the coaching staff that I work with, you know, sometimes, you know, they'll do things at practice that aren't, you know, in line with what they said they were going to do. Because with, well, especially with wrestlers, it can change day to day depending on what training partners show up and so on. Rather than me making any judgment calls on what's going on in terms of the amount of loading the athletes are under, you know, it's quick walk upstairs. Hey, coach, can I talk to you? What's going on? What do you see here? And, you know, we work together because at the end of the day, it's not about me. It's not about the coach. It's about the athlete and ensuring that, you know, their well-being and, you know, is taken care of and that we get them to where they need to go. And I am competitive as heck. So I want them to win, you know, just as much as they do.
Right.
And so we might as well, you know, cross off the T's and dot the I's. So I can't think of anything, you know, concrete, but I'm sure if you asked anybody that knows me, they'll probably be able to tell you. Yeah, she put it up here real bad, you know, but.
We all have for sure. Is that something that you did? I mean, early on, you know, you were able to address, I think the biggest thing with young coaches, especially a lot of the young coaches that listen to the show, is that, you know, the lowest form of leadership is that positional leadership where they all of a sudden they're the coach. So people are expected to do what they say. And then all of a sudden you have those situations where an athlete doesn't want to listen to what you say, you know, how you address that often becomes this emotional response of screaming and yelling or getting in an athlete's face, whatever it may be, you know. Have you always had that kind of demeanor where, you know, you're just going to pull them aside and have that conversation about the habits of a world champion and all that? Or, you know, have you had those moments where it's been, you know, you've been?
No, definitely when I was younger, I was more volatile and more emotional for sure, you know, or more visibly frustrated, we'll say. Now, as I've grown, definitely way more calm, cool, and collected. And I've spent a lot of time working with business coaches and working with people that teach courses in emotional intelligence and in communication. So I've invested a lot of time in that area, Ron, to be honest. It's because, you know, when you're sort of attracted to a field that is competitive and you're working with competitive athletes, there's going to be, you know, emotions will run high sometimes. So, I mean, I've never ever lost it on an athlete or screamed and yelled. I've never been a screamer, but I definitely don't show visible frustration the way that I did when I was younger and less experienced.
Mm. So you're not the first coach, strength coach to work with wrestling or be a professor or, you know, be a female strength coach in a male dominated profession or whatever. You're not the first. What is it that makes you unique though? Why have you had so much success at this high level?
I'm not the first. Oh my goodness. I thought I was. Okay.
I know, right?
Well, then, since you've now shattered my dreams. you know, I do think that the combination between being an academic and being under the hot seat, like I'm under the hot seat as an academic because I have to be teaching, you know, things to students that are evidence-based and I can back up. Okay. And maybe they're not based on an exact study, but I can, you know, sort of theorize my way through the physiology or the biomechanics to give them an explanation as to why we're doing what we're doing or how the body adapts or responds to a stimulus. So that carries over into my coaching. And I can, you know, if you came up to me in the gym and asked me, hey, why are you doing this? You know, definitely I'd have an answer for you. So I would say what separates me is I've got two key people in my communication group that are mentors that are very, very high level coaches. Both of them have coached Olympians they are older than me. They are wiser than me. And they are two guys that will always put me in the hot seat. And I've actually invited a third because I like torture. And he's a professor that I'm working with as well. And they just constantly grill me. And it's good because it keeps me honest and it keeps me on my toes. A lot of times I might not know the answer, but it makes me constantly be searching for something to use to explain, you know, why I'm doing what I'm doing. So maybe that's not unique about me, but that's definitely me. And, you know, I really enjoy teaching. And I think maybe what might be unique is that my ability to teach really complicated, like, physiology to college kids does also bleed into the weight room, because I might be teaching a complicated exercise like a power clean to a new athlete.
Right.
And I'm able to create context right away. So even the foot position, I can relate it back to their sport and then go, oh, okay, I understand that. Okay, got it. And I'm going to do this. And that relates to something else that they already understand and know and is in with their, you know, within their repertoire. So meaningful learning experiences are important to me, because then I can do my job faster and the athletes will also improve quicker. So it's beneficial for everybody.
No, I couldn't agree with you more. I think, you know, obviously having the you know, the strong academic background and then the strong coaching background is that unique blend of being able to do both. I mean, I've had, you know, academics on the show in the past that, you know, let's face it, sometimes not all, every single one of them have ever even been in a weight room, let alone.
Do they teach with an accent? Do they talk like this when they are explaining the mitochondria, the most important part of the cell? And if you do not exercise, you will be.
That's exactly right.
You know, like,
exactly right.
I have a lot of fun while I'm teaching, because I like young people. You know, it keeps me young and they're funny. So
absolutely. What, you know, in the academic world, I mean, obviously when you're this coach, and I think you got a presentation that's coming up, right? Or you know, working on something that's, you know, think like a scientist, act like a coach, you know? So when you're in that academic setting, but you've got that coach mentality, sometimes it's probably like, man, hold, you know, sometimes you got to pull yourself back in a big, big way, I would think, you know, and
I do. I have to leave my super person at the door, Ron. That's what my business coach has told me. So I do. I'm a dialed down version of my hyper self.
Right.
But I'll be honest, like when it comes to classroom management, like texting in class, you know, you'll hear me say something like, so guys, if you're looking at your crotch and you're smiling, I know what you're doing. Right. So that's a coach, right? Where the teacher might not say something like that. So I do have a little bit of trouble separating the two, but at the end of the day, you know, I think using humor is really important.
No question.
And, you know, being human to these young kids and these athletes, like whoever you're teaching or working with, I think that's important too, because then you can connect with them. Right. So anyway, I'll probably get fired for saying that, but,
shoot. Well, I wasn't, I mean, maybe not even going towards the students. I'm thinking almost within the academic community of, you know, your colleagues other professors, and that, you know, I've been on the show and I've talked to people in the past and I've talked about how, you know, as a strength coach, I'm appalled or I'm upset with our profession in that, you know, we're not the leaders when it comes to bringing research ideas and conducting research to the forefront, because as practitioners, we're in it. We're in the front lines, you know, and we have the best subjects and, you know, to use for data and data collection and, to be able to see trends and analyze and the whole deal. But, you know, but at the same time, there's plenty of things as a practitioner where the science hasn't quite caught up to, we know it works. We know it works as a coach.
Oh, you know, I don't think so. You know? I think the science is right there. I don't know. I think there's a lack of understanding. I think there's a lack of people like me teaching it to strength coaches personally and putting it on their level instead of textbook, right? Where it's like, in this exact example, this is what happens. That's the problem. There's just too much of a gap between what the kids are learning in school and how it applies, but it does. It does apply. And I think that's what I might do a pretty good job of.
Yeah, I think it's fantastic. Well, I think that, and that's my point is that, so, you know, there's got that, having that blend of academic and practitioner is rare, you know, it's rare to find. And it's the reason why we have so many smart coaches that are out there, like yourself, like Brian Mann, that have gone on for advanced education and gotten their PhDs and are going and teaching. And we all know that we learn more by teaching than we do by just learning, you know, obviously learning. And so I think we need to continue to progress and motivate coaches to get those advanced degrees and continue to teach and continue to give back and do it both in, you know, I would say that I would maybe, you know, say that you're teaching as much to your athletes in the weight room as you do sometimes to your students, I would think, you know, in terms of, 100%. You know, and they're retaining the information that they're retaining is probably on another level, you know. And what would you say, I guess my question in all that is, what would you say to strength coaches on how we can get better at, you know, at understanding the science?
That's a great question. You know, maybe I'll be critical of what I do see. And I see a lot of systems. I see a lot of cookie cutter ideology. I see a lot of constructs. What I mean by that is, like, here's a graph. This is the general adaptation syndrome. This happens first, then this happens next. And everything is so vague. And then the strength coach is sitting there listening and nodding. And then I say to them, okay, I want you to design a general preparation conditioning program for this soccer team. Go. And they are like, I don't know where to start. And it's not their fault. Like, they're smart. They were paying attention. They were there. They're doing everything right, except something is missing, and it's details. Too many people are talking about philosophy, and I was really hoping you'd ask me for my philosophy today, because I was going to come back with saying, you know, I don't have a philosophy. We are not philosophers.
Agreed.
You know, we are coaches who use exercise, you know, to elicit an adaptation in physiology.
Right.
You know, and then we also want to create an environment, right? Which I'll leave that to Brett, because, you know, Mr. Bartholomew is the expert now in that area, and he's phenomenal. And I agree with that, because you can't get the adaptation without that stuff too. But if we were talking purely about the body as a kind of a machine adapting to exercise, you know, a lot of coaches aren't really sure, you know, sort of how that all happens, you know, because I don't think it's necessarily explained well in textbooks. And I don't know if the PhDs teaching are explaining it very well, because it often pertains to their own research, which can be quite pigeonholed,
skewed,
and
right.
only applied to a very specific population.
Right.
So there are some gaps, and, you know, my goal is to try to start filling that gap with this new talk I'm putting together. I'm also going to be rolling out a bunch of 5 to 7 minute tutorials. They're like MOV files. They'll be uploaded. I don't know where yet, but we're just putting them together on just, you know, little physiological facts, not factoids, and they're not sound bites, because we have enough of those too, but it's to explain enough about a phenomena that we observe, because all of us as coaches are observing it. We're like, whoa, that's right. So cool that this just happened. If we understood better why it happened, and if we could predict better how it's going to happen, then we'd actually get even better at prescribing our training plans, in my opinion. But there is a gap right now. You know, there are some good resources and good books, but not everybody is, you know, dedicated to sit down and read an exercise physiology textbook. And they're busy, too, and right. to retain it as well. So somehow we have to get some of the stuff out to people. You know, so if people out there listening have any ideas, you know, email me.
Yeah.
Let me know. What can I do? What can I do to help? And that will direct my plan, because I only know what I know.
Right, right. Well, I don't ask the philosophy question, because I always say that I'm a principle-based strength coach, not a philosophy-based strength coach. You know, and that's just it. I mean, we can have conversations across – when we talk about principles, we can have conversations across many platforms. But, you know, I agree with you. I think so many times we dive into these philosophies without first fully understanding and knowing – the roots or how they came about, but then we turn around and we close our minds to any and every other philosophy principle based program there is. And I think that's a kiss of death in this profession, I think, because you're always going to find yourself in a situation where you know, the philosophy doesn't apply, you know, and you have to go back to the drawing board. So I agree with you. As an academic, though, in the weight room, this is kind of maybe this is a better way of wording the question I wanted to get to earlier is there's going to be times where you think something works. It's almost like the scientific process, right? Okay. You formed a hypothesis of what you think might work in the weight room has yet been researched to know that it absolutely works. What's your process then as a coach to test out your hypothesis in the weight room?
Well, it's exactly what you just said, you know, test, retest. So let's just use an example. Let's say the textbook says in between like maximal strength work of 3 RM, the athlete should be resting 3 to 5 minutes. And my athlete's in there. And after 2.5 minutes, she says to me, okay, Carmen, I'm ready to go. What do I say? No, you need to rest for another 60 seconds. And then I end up distracting her and she sort of becomes less aroused, we'll say. I can't measure that, but let's just sort of throw that out there. And then she goes and does the next set and her performance is worse than the set prior. So I think there needs to be obviously some observations by coaches. We take notes. I take notes all the time. I take notes with my video camera. Mm-hmm. As well as, you know, pen and paper, old school. And then we can go out and we can start testing our hypotheses, if you will. Because I kind of look at it as everybody has the opportunity to be a scientist. And, right. You know, everybody throws the word data around like it's like a really important thing.
Right.
Oh, the data I collected, my data. Well, if I told someone to do 3 sets of 10 at 200 pounds, that's data. It's just information. So keep collecting it, you know, and keep record of everything if you can. And then, you know, from there you can start to formulate your own little mini experiments in the off season. And that's another reason why we test. I'm big on testing. So people are like, oh, no, don't test. That's for parents. Don't do testing. I said, well, testing serves a lot of purposes.
Agreed.
And it gives me a really good idea of where these athletes are at. And that's why we do a battery of tests.
And how well?
Contests
and how well your program's addressing those needs.
Exactly. Right. So, you know, I had an athlete that started with me. She's a heavyweight wrestler. She's not really a heavyweight. She's actually walks around at her weight, about 74 kilos. She can power clean 92 kilos when I started working with her. And I kind of kept on the same sort of vein that she was on originally when I took over for another coach. And then as I started to observe more and more, I mean, we went and tested her. We tested her squat, tested her bench, tested her clean. She's quote unquote strong, but she's really long legged and short through the body and extremely explosive in short ranges of motion. But what does wrestling entail?
Right.
You know, deep range of motion deep angles and generating tension from extremely compromised positions. So we started to expose some of that in the weight room and I ended up changing her program entirely. She was doing Zercher squats and Cossack squats and all kinds of different exercises to start to work on the deficits that I had observed, even though I didn't measure those deficits, right? I observed them. I could see she couldn't control her power from deep angles. Maybe we could call that mobility. I don't know. Okay. Strength through range of motion control, mobility. Thank you very much. So anyway, she's, you know, a lot more well-rounded now. Her power clean's up to 95 kilos. That took me like a year.
Right.
So did I make her stronger? I don't know. But she is when we look at, you know, sort of every particular exercise we're now doing, right? So every time you have an athlete doing an exercise, a drill, an endurance protocol, whatever, observe, write everything down.
Right.
I write it on the whiteboard and then I just take photos of it. So that's how I take notes. And I keep track of, with my endurance stuff, with my wrestlers, we keep track of velocity on everything. So with like using battling ropes or sleds or whatever we're using, everything's based on time and distance.
Mm-hmm.
Versus just going like, you know, crazy and then taking a break, right? So we're trying to hit targets every session. It helps the athletes too. They stay on track. They like it.
Right.
I only hit 50 on that round instead of 51. And, you know, it's not a big deal, but, you know, they think it is and it keeps them motivated.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. And that's something, you know, as, you know, somebody that came out of undergrad with a biology degree and then obviously advanced degrees and things on those lines. I mean, it's, I'm a scientist. It just, the laboratory is the weight room for me. And that's the way that I approach it. And
sure.
I very much approach my program design, like the scientific process. And this is what I think is going to work. And then I observe and I test and retest and make adjustments all the way throughout. And I think that's why it's so important as coaches that we record workout data. You know, I mean, so many coaches that I've seen just, you know, it's a workout that's up on the board, or, you know, maybe they give them a card, but they're not recording the data. And I'm just like, that's, you're not doing that. You know,
you're right. It's only half of it. You're writing a program, but if you're not actually getting the numbers, and I always ask the girls, did you hit your numbers?
Right.
And they'll let me know by text usually that night if I'm not there. Oh, I didn't hit my numbers on these ones or whatever. So right. I need to know that. It impacts my decision for the next day.
That's exactly right. And then, like you said, testing, I think, is so important as well, not just from a standpoint of just seeing where, you know, where they're at and the numbers and goal setting and all that kind of stuff, but really just having an understanding of how your program's affecting the athlete is critical, in my opinion, you know? And so I agree with you 100% on that.
You know, like, I think that we've gotten like too influenced by the therapy crowd. Like, let them do their job, let them do a musculoskeletal screen and a physical evaluation, and let the strength and conditioning coaches do a performance testing. And I think if we stay in our lanes, you know, people, the athlete gets a better experience, a more professional experience.
Well, I think, you know, and obviously to that point, I think a lot of them are fearful of injuries and things on those lines. Coaches are fearful of injuries and things on those lines. What test, I mean, with specifically grapplers, with wrestlers, what test are you evaluating your wrestlers with?
Well, Ron, I just finished writing a testing manual, now that you ask.
I did not know that.
Yeah, I did. It'll be Corey Beasley of Fight Camp Conditioning will be, yeah, be selling it off of his website. I don't know, or maybe giving it away. I'm not sure, but it's really my life. But anyway, you know, we do your typical strength testing if the athletes are experienced in the lift. So power clean, squat, bench,
right,
chin ups for max reps. We do push ups, max number. We also do push ups number in 1 minute. For conditioning, Wrestling Canada runs a cool test. It's called a RIAT, spelled RHIET, which is like a repeated sprint test. And we can calculate a fatigue. We can get a 30-meter sprint time, and then we can also calculate a fatigue index off of it. You know, and then I'll also do, you know, your typical either a beep test or 1.5-mile run, which is a 2.4K run test, correlate that to a VO2 score just to get a general foundation. But one of the key tests that I think is most important above and beyond really all of that is something called a critical power test.
Okay.
And a critical power test gives us a better idea of what training zones we need to prescribe for the athlete, such that they are either working above or below their anaerobic threshold. And that's how we build a big engine. Even a wrestler, you know, people say, well, they're not an endurance athlete, they're not a runner. And I said, if you know what, if you have a wrestler wrestle 5 matches in a day and they go the distance on every single match they're doing, and then you include their warm-ups, which are sometimes like 15-20 minutes long, they could be doing upwards of an hour to an hour and a half of aerobic, high intensity aerobic exercise in 1 day.
Right.
So, you know, it's just because if you look at the sport and you just analyze the match, right, 3 minutes on, 30 seconds off, 3 minutes on. You know, sure, we could argue till we're blue in the face that it's an anaerobic event, but we're actually, you know, we're preparing them to last for that full day or for 2 days in a tournament setting, which is typical. Then right. what are we doing to improve their physiology to support the demands of their sport?
Right.
You know, so it's, I really kind of struggle with the whole, like, let's analyze the sport from an energy system standpoint. It's fairly limiting in terms of, you know, really fully understanding what the athlete needs to achieve from a fitness standpoint. So critical power testing is the test, and it's I'll be writing about that as well, everybody, for Corey's site. So if you guys are interested, then it'll be up there too, and I'll teach you how to do it real easy.
Yeah, it's great. I think, and Corey's been on the show as well, so people can go back and listen to that episode as
awesome.
Well.
Awesome.
Yeah. The when you're dealing with wrestlers specifically, you know, and I mean I know you work with MMA and some mixed martial artists, BJJ and whatnot. What are you seeing as a common theme across the board as to maybe the biggest deficiency that they're coming in with?
Well, you know, a lot of them come in with a lack of neck strength, to be honest.
Really?
And that's the interesting part. So it's actually not really a neck strength issue. It's often a proprioceptive problem. They'll come in and complain, you know, of like getting repeated stingers and having chronic neck stiffness. So the team chiropractor and I have been working sort of on some theories, right? They're working theories because there's not a lot of literature. I've looked it up to find out, you know, sort of what would be normal for a wrestler. We're sort of the mindset that they should be fairly stiff in the neck in terms of like, you know, mobility, because they need that kind of strength, just like a football player would.
Right.
But their proprioceptive system, because they get injured there so frequently, sometimes needs to be sharpened. We'll just say that for now. So, you know, a lot of it is very specific positional exercises where they're holding their head in a particular position, which is usually neutral, while they're getting like a perturbation of the joint. So we'll do a lot of that early on with the younger girls and guys. Lots of tight hips just from being chronically in a crouched position, poor posture, which, you know, I don't know about the wrestler posture, if it needs to be fixed on the mats or not. You look at the Russians, they've got good posture. You look at some of the Americans, and the Iranians, they have bad posture, like from a postural standpoint. I don't even really know what posture means, so I don't know why I'm talking about it. And I don't really know if it affects their explosiveness, their power, or their back health.
Right.
You know, we just don't know yet.
It probably does as they age, but as a competitive athlete, probably not so much.
Absolutely. You know, so who knows? But, you know, I'm still big on posture. We'll call it position or good form in the weight room. So I don't let them, you know, do deadlifts with a scared dog bum and they look like a cat vomiting, you know, that kind of look. Right. So everything looks really good in the weight room. And so it should. And, you know, so we're dealing with posture and neck stuff. And then I think you and I talked about this briefly, like just sort of this overemphasis of local muscular endurance. Well, for the muscles to be able to generate a lot of ATP quickly, we actually need to do conditioning. And that conditioning doesn't need to be so like crazy and weird and have all these wrestling specific things in it. It can be, you know, running protocols or running and using a sled or doing battling rope drills and a rowing machine. Like there's lots of modalities that are really effective. Just building up the threshold for that particular athlete and then also improving their strength, right? Because power and power endurance both swim in a sea of strength. So if you're not strong, and strong is an extremely general construct, we would need to operationalize that and really define it. But, you know, if the person's not strong, they're not going to be that powerful or that explosive. So I'm not necessarily seeing kids that are that strong right off the bat, like out of high school. So that, you know, the focus is proprioception of the neck, strength, and then aerobic base. And then we go from there.
That's interesting. I would have never get
with base with circuit training, right? Like CrossFit style stuff, right? It does nothing for these athletes. It's not specific enough.
I agree with you 100% on that. Well, Carmen, we end the show with some resources here. Give us the best piece of coaching advice you ever received.
My husband gives me the best coaching advice. He always tells me to keep paddling. Because, you know, the role of a coach isn't glamorous and you're not, you know, what are you doing this for, you know, and it's not for me and that's okay. You know, I'm a mom too, so I'm used to this and I actually really enjoy kind of a behind the scenes role in this world, in this lifetime. I really sincerely do. You know, but there can be a lot of work sometimes and a lot of late nights and, you know, upset athletes. There's a lot that goes on just outside of just, you know, the hour that you're with the client, you know, especially when you get close to them and you're helping them get to a major competition, like a world championship or an Olympic Games or a Super Bowl type situation. So, you know, my husband always tells me, keep paddling. Yeah, and it's like saying, keep your chin up, right? And you tell athletes that, but coaches need to hear it too.
Sure. No, I agree with you 100%.
We can do this. You know, everybody can do this. We can all empower each other.
Well, that's why we're in it, right? Ultimately, is to make an impact in other people's lives and maximize the number of people we touch so that we can impact our influence.
Absolutely. Could not agree more. It's so rewarding. Like, you know, really is. I'm lucky.
Give us a book, app, and website recommendation. And I know where you're going with the website recommendation, but I want to hear it anyways.
Awesome. Do not go to the website for information, you people. Come on, challenge yourself. Pick up the book, The Physiology of Training for High Performance by McDougall and Sale. Challenge yourself. You know, blogs and websites are a good starting point, but if you think that's where you're going to get a comprehensive understanding of what's happening in the body, you just won't, you know. And then, unfortunately, with websites, they're not necessarily peer-reviewed or scientifically vetted, so I cannot endorse that reference. Same with YouTube University and other such materials. Apps, oh gosh. I've been locked out of the App Store, to be honest with you guys, because I've changed my password too many times, so I have to call Apple after this podcast and figure that out. But you know, I like the push app because with the push device, but I can't say that I'm completely guided by that. I like the ScreenFlow app, but that has probably nothing to do with your coaches unless they want to make screencasts. And it's a good app. If you want to edit video and create like little tutorials for your athletes, it's a phenomenal tool.
It is.
So maybe I'll leave it with that one because it might be a bit unique for your readership.
No, I think it's great. And that's actually what I use for these podcasts, ScreenFlow.
ScreenFlow? Yeah. Oh, there you go.
Absolutely.
Think alike. Love it.
There you go. Well, Carmen, it's been awesome. I mean, I told you even on the front end that we try to keep it to 20 minutes and we went to 42.
Oh, God.
Which is great because it just means that the conversation was awesome. And you know, I think anytime that I meet people that are doing things at an extremely high level that are unique, that are pushing the envelope in one capacity or another, I think is people that I want to be around. And you're doing that on many, many different fronts. And we're so thankful and appreciative of people like you and Dr. you know, Brian Mann and other strength coaches that have gone out and gotten their PhDs and are finding ways to do both, blend both roles and continue to push the envelope there. And I think that's so important that we need to, as a community, as a strength and conditioning community, we need to continue to do that. We need to continue to make sure we're challenging ourselves in the weight room to follow the scientific process and to contribute back to that body of knowledge in different ways, because there's a lot of people doing some great things, but it has to be supported for us to ever be taken as a legitimate profession. And people like you doing it, it paves the way. So appreciate you coming on the show and sharing. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Ron. Thanks for listening, everybody. You guys have a great day.
That's it for this episode of Iron Game Chalk Talk. Thanks to this week's guest, as well as our sponsors, for bringing this episode to you for free. Make sure to check out ronmckeefree.com, where you can join our mailing list, find the show notes, including all the links and resources mentioned, and information about Coach McKeefree's other products. While you are there, please join Coach McKeefree in the comments section thanking our guest for sharing. If you haven't subscribed to Iron Game Chalk Talk on YouTube or iTunes yet, make sure to do so. Comments, ratings, and reviews are always welcome. Coach McKeefree can be found on Twitter at @rmckeefree. On Facebook and YouTube at @ron.mckeefree. That's it for this week. Be sure to check back next week for another great episode of Iron Game Chalk Talk.